Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome back to the Rational Faiths Podcast, the best podcast on the blabbernacle. I am your host, Brian Dillman. I hope you all have had a wonderful Christmas. I'm certain that if you listened to the last episode on the topic of Christmas, you all went out and read Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. I did, and I found it really quite the tale. Interesting Christmas ghosty story indeed. Before we talk about the episode today, I want to remind you all of the Rational Faiths fundraiser for the Liahona Children's Foundation. We are doing really well. We've funded over 90% of our goal of $10,000. I don't know what the total is right now because I'm actually on vacation in Utah as of the time of this episode release. So help me out here. Go to the Indiegogo page. Make sure it's over the $10,000 mark. If it's not, donate something there, please. If all the listeners donated $2, we would blow our goal out of the water. So go donate $2. As for the episode today, we have another installment of the Top 10 Books in Mormon History with Ben Park. This is part 9 of the series, and here we discuss Greg Prince's biography of David O. McKay, The Rise of Modern Mormonism. So with that short intro in hand, let's jump right to it. All right, Ben, we're back to talk about one of the favorite biographies in our collection, David O. McKay and the Rise of Modern Mormonism. How are you doing tonight before we get going?
I'm doing all right. Hanging in there, Brian.
Excellent. We're coming into the final stretch. So this is one of the books that, along with Rough Stone Rolling and Quinn books and a couple others, that get suggested quite a bit as essential. And obviously you think so because you put it in your top 10 Mormon history books. So let's talk about it. Let's start off talking about this biography that covers a very important president of the church in the middle of the 20th century.
First of all, I'll kind of give reasons on why I included it. Mostly, especially kind of defending myself against myself, because I am generally, because I'm generally a critic of biographies, especially Mormon biographies. I think they're often too tedious. I think they don't capture broader pictures. I think they're like, oh, this is a great look at, in general, an old dead white man.
Yeah.
But I think that, mostly because of the dearth of 20th century Mormon history stuff, you end up having to focus on books like this. If you look at the great books on 20th century Mormon history, excluding Moss's Angel in the Beehive, which is the outlier, most of them are revolved around document collections that the author has somehow gotten access to. And in this case, you have an author who gets access to a treasure trove of sources and therefore can write a history of David O. McKay and the rise of modern Mormonism. And I think it should be important to note that I don't think anyone's ever written a biography on someone and said, this person is not the conduit of the rise of modern such and such, right? I mean, the task of the biography is to overstate.
This is a minor figure.
right. I mean, that's just not very common biographical trend. So, I mean, this is kind of a genre to focus on an individual and say, he is the hinge upon which modern Mormonism turns. And so I think we should have that in mind as we're going into, and I bet someone can say the same thing about Joseph F. Smith. Someone could say the same thing about Heber J. Grant. Someone has said the same thing about Spencer W. Kimball.
Yeah.
So, but I think in reading this book, you can see that a lot of important stuff does happen with McKay. Whether this is the point of the rise of modern Mormonism, I'm not sure. But hey, it's a title that sells books, which is, you know, the point.
Yeah.
But I will say, if you're wanting to, if you're debating on 20th century Mormon history from the institutional perspective, the best two biographies are this one or Edward Kimball's biography of Spencer W. Kimball. Now, there's one biography that he writes with someone else on Spencer W. Kimball's youth and adulthood and apostolic years, and then another biography of his presidency. Both are spectacular, so I recommend those as extra readings on top of this one if you're especially interested.
And one thing, that one, I don't know if this is a Deseret Book thing or he just wanted to publish it that way, but the actual book, if I remember right, doesn't have footnotes in it, but you get a CD with it that has two different versions of the book, one with regular footnotes and then one with extensive footnotes.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story behind that. In fact, you can read on the one of the opening pages of the Kimball biography. It's published by Deseret Book, and it says, I'm paraphrasing because I don't have it in front of me, something like, the author and the publisher could not come to agreement on certain terms. So a compromise is that we have this published version of the book, and in the CD you can have an author's version, which is much longer, gets into much more controversial stuff. And yeah, I don't know of any other book that's like it in format.
Although I think the prose is the bits that I've looked at seem identical. The differences in the controversy would be in the footnotes. Do you remember that?
Yeah, footnotes, and there are extensive additions within the chapters too. There are a few chapters that have lots and lots of extra pages.
Okay.
And to be honest, I mean, there is good stuff in it, but there's lots and lots of stuff that would generally be cut out in a first draft, which is what the CD version is. It's a rough draft. And so it's the CD version is mostly for, you know, the extra nerds who really want to get into the nitty gritty. But the published version, and I say this as an academic who's into, you know, warts and all history, I really think the published version that Deseret Book agreed with is still really good. And so you don't have to wait into the CD version. And yeah. But anyways, that's the Kimball biography.
Yeah.
Extra credit reading for you listeners.
There you go. Yeah. So this one, as you're talking about the source material for The Rise of Modern Mormonism, David O. McKay's biography, and he talks about this in the preface or the introduction. I was blown away with the volume of material that was, first of all, documented by McKay's secretary as his journal, and then second of all, read and used by Greg Prince and Robert Wright to create this really summary of McKay's presidency.
Right. And so let's discuss that right now, because it's fascinating. As I mentioned, most of these 20th century works depend on if you're able to get access to particular documents, because, you know, when you do 20th century, you have to do it from an institutional level. So therefore, it's based on private records, which, of course, we know is nonsense. But that's typically how history has been done in our field. But what happens here is William Robert Wright, I believe, is the nephew of Claire Middlemiss. There's some relation there.
Mm-hmm.
But through the family, he gets access to Claire Middlemiss's office diaries, which are, you know, pseudo David O. McKay diaries, the diaries that Claire Middlemiss kept for David O. McKay when she was his secretary throughout his presidency years. And these are voluminous. They're not diaries in the way that you would think of. It's not him dictating to her, "Dear diary, on this day." I mean, you got very few personal reflections, but you have accounts of meetings, you have accounts of who he met with, what was going on, which is just a unmatched look into the presidency during the 20th century. And so William Robert Wright gets access to these, approaches Greg Prince and says, "Hey, do you want to write a biography?" And they agree. And then the way that they balance the load was Greg Prince ended up doing a vast majority of the writing, with William Robert Wright kind of supporting and giving feedback and such.
Yeah. Yeah. And when I've heard Greg talk about his other book that is kind of famous, the one about priesthood, The Power from On High, he often says that he went through every church periodical to find any article that talked about the priesthood. And this seemed the same way, because, I mean, these journals, they're bookshelves. Like, there's just so many of them. And I've felt somewhat bored and tedious just getting through a bunch of the books that I've read this year. let alone these volumes upon volumes of diaries and much of which I think would be quite bland. And so he was pretty committed to consume all the relevant information that he could get his hands on.
Right, and I should note that Brian Whitney is currently going through and editing these diaries for publication for Coford Press, which is pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So there'll more analysis can be done on them.
Right, because I mean that is a unparalleled source for the institutional LDS Church during the mid 20th century. So it's cool. So, anyways, let's talk a little bit more about the authors, especially Greg Prince, because what Greg Prince demonstrates more than what we have of other authors so far this series is he has no academic appointment. He's not a professional scholarly historian, and which might surprise readers of the book because the book is really, really good. But what Greg Prince represents is the vast armies of strongly skilled amateur historians who go out. You know, this is Mormons love their history. I mean, I doubt. Any of our listeners are academic historians, which shows that, you know, it's lots of Latter-day Saints who are interested in Mormon history. And Greg Prince is one of those who say, you know what, I can participate in history as well. So he goes out and he writes the first book, which you already mentioned, his Power from On High book, which looks at early Mormon priesthood narratives. And then when this new opportunity came up, he goes, well, you know what, this is a new project I can go. And he does a very good job with it. I think as you read it, especially in comparison to the other books we read in this series, there are some very clear differences, just in due to background and training. With Prince's books, you'll see a lot more block quotes.
Yep.
You'll see a lot more general narrative or general facts, less analysis, less contextualization, less theory. Maybe less of a thesis that's addressed to a broader audience, but more of a focused on common Latter-day Saint issues. If you go through the thematic chapters of the book, you'll realize, oh, that's a chapter that's interested to Mormons. Oh, you know what? That's a chapter that's interested to Mormons. No, that's a chapter interesting to Mormons. So it's really framed around what Mormons like, which is really good because the majority of readers are Mormons. But it's definitely one important thing to keep in mind while reading this book is the differences it would have from a scholarly or academic productions.
Yeah, I think, for instance, let me turn to the table of contents to point out some of these chapters. So he talks a lot about how the church grew in different ways during McKay's presidency. So he talks about radio and television broadcasting, correlation in church administration, the education system, the building program, the missionary program, temple building, all of those things that could probably be summarized into one chapter if it were meant for a general audience. But Mormons would think, oh, I want to know about this in specific. I want to know, you know, why did BYU not spread out like my grandpa had told me about? There was a plan at one point, and he goes through that. And lots of that stuff that are interesting to insiders, but outsiders, it's just too much detail and too much inside baseball.
It's so much information, which makes it to where if you're reading a academic book, there's usually one thesis that's driving the narrative, and you kind of have to read the entire book to get an overall understanding of what's being argued here. Whereas in this book, I mean, I recommend reading it from cover to cover because it's just so fascinating. But you can also kind of use it as a reference volume if you're like, huh, how did Mormon correlation develop during the 1950s? And you can just crack it up, and there's all the information you need.
Yeah, exactly. The comparison could be a couple of them, like The Mormon Question, Flake's book, and Paul Reeves' book that have a pretty consistent narrative, or not narrative, but consistent argument, like you were saying, that kind of takes different flavors for each chapter or each period of time.
Right.
But it's pretty consistent in what they're getting at. And like you were saying, a lot of the quotes from the different documents are carefully crafted to put into sentences rather than taking a paragraph from a journal.
Or they're summarized.
Yeah, or they're summarized.
Yeah. So it definitely does have a different feel, and it's different than the Rough Stone Rolling biography, because that one kind of went pretty much linearly through his life.
Right.
And this one is focused on, like you said, what Mormons would be interested in, different aspects of the church that went, that changed during McKay's presidency.
So that's a good way to transition into talking about the content of the book. What did you think about the thematic organization? Because this is very different than anything else that we've discussed so far this year.
So I enjoyed it because for the reasons that you already said, that at first I looked at the chapters that I just read off and I thought, good grief, why is this interesting? But then as I read it, I didn't know about all these inside stories and the personalities like Ernest Wilkinson.
Right.
It was interesting because it did show through these different ways, through the building program, through the education program, through the missionary program even, how different personalities and different positions have impact on church policy or on church program implementation or construction.
Right.
So in that aspect, it was really neat. But a friend of mine, when I finished reading this book, I gave it 5 stars on Goodreads. And a friend of mine had also read it. He gave it 4. And I said, how could you give it 4? And he said, well, some of it got kind of tedious. And I'm like, yeah, I guess, yeah, it could get tedious because it's like you're doing Back to the Future over and over again. And then you go down a different alley each time.
Right. I mean, there are clear drawbacks of this because it becomes tedious. It becomes repetitive. I think you can lose the overall narrative of how some of these themes relate together or develop at the same time. And perhaps maybe one of the biggest problems with this whole book is you get it. You read this whole book and you think, my gosh, how much of this actually happened over McKay's life? And then you actually look into it and most of it happens like in the first 3 years. And because it's not a chronological narrative, you don't realize that McKay is basically a vegetable for his last 10 years.
Right.
Without doing much. But with those as the downsides, what I think that this thematic approach accomplishes is shows how multifaceted modern Mormonism was by the 1950s. How many different things were going on. Which sometimes become a bit one-dimensional in thinking about how the church develops or how history works. Whereas this book really reminds that at any given year, you have these 15 main themes running off in different avenues that have to be handled. And I mean, that's a complex modern organization right there.
Yeah, I think that's the value of it, is it's a case study of what might be going on right now, whether right now means 10 years ago when the book was written or maybe 10 years in the future. You know, as you see aging leaders, you see different social and political movements change over the last 10 years, for instance. And this is a case study to show that it's not just some dude, you know, in a building saying, okay, this is what we're going to do next. There's all kinds of personalities and interests and influences that get into how decisions are made. And I think that's the greatest value, is it's a case study, and it makes you, for a Mormon, it's really fascinating because it gives you an idea of what might be going on in the COB right now.
No, and I think that this is crucial because, I mean, if there's any vague thesis in the book, it's that during the McKay presidency, Mormonism transitions into being a modern organization. Now, what he means by modern is never fully defined satisfactorily, but I think we can glean what Prince means as modern, or more importantly, what David O. McKay would have thought was modern. And that was this multifaceted organization that is working on several different things at once, and is exploring lots of different avenues, and in many cases is adopting broader cultural norms of practice and not being at the secluded, exclusive church that Mormonism was prior to McKay's ascension.
Yeah, and I think it, again, with the case study theme, you could say the same thing for Joseph F. Smith, Heber J. Grant, and
yep.
Spencer Kimball, where the church grew, it expanded, it became more global, and there were key events that signaled that growth or shift. And this is just one iteration of those.
Yeah, I agree. So now let's get into, before we talk about specific themes, I want to know, what did you think of David O'Mahey coming out of this book? What are your impressions of the figure that is sculpted by Greg Prince here?
So going into it, because I didn't know much about him other than how he looked in pictures, and that's pretty much it. I mean, all the gospel doctrine manuals or quotes that you get, it could be from any president, and it doesn't matter because they generally seem to craft those books to teach certain topics, not necessarily to get to know a president of the church. So going into it, I knew he was a nice looking guy and people say nice things about him. And coming out of it, I felt really tired for one thing, especially the communism chapter, which we'll talk about. And I felt like, I guess, the same critique that people laid on Mitt Romney during his different campaigns of being a flip-flopper or being wishy-washy, where, you know, this straddling the middle ground, you just get pulled back and forth, and you see that getting pulled from Ezra Taft Benson on one side and Hubie Brown on the other side, back and forth all day long. And I think that's part of the reason why I felt so tired towards the end of it, as he's aging through each of these themes. I felt more of an affinity toward him. He seemed like a nice guy with a lot of the quotes, someone that would make you feel good. And a lot of the people that got to know him, different political figures that would visit Utah and started to become friends with David O'Mahey, even though they might have differed on political opinion. He seems like someone that I would have liked to have known had I been a peer or close to being a peer. But he also, he's a good leader, but not as strong as reading Pioneer Prophet and coming away with a feel of Brigham Young. Like, Brigham Young knows what he's going to do and he's going to do it. And David O'Mahey kind of knows what he's going to do, and it's not sure if he's going to be able to follow through with it.
And even that kind of knows what he's doing is an improvement on previous historiography. Because, I mean, McKay in Michael Quinn's hands has no real backbone. He sides on whoever he talks with last. And in Quinn's Mormon Hierarchy volumes, McKay is kind of a pushover, and things are happening around him, but not really by him. Whereas I think what Prince is trying to do here is he's really trying to restore McKay as someone who's actually pushing a lot of these changes, which I think in some cases is right. But I think in other cases, it might be a bit of a stretch. And especially during his last decade when he's just not that active, I think he's just more of a personal person who's trying to, who thinks that agreement, unanimity, and avoiding contention are the most important principles in their councils.
Yeah, that was one of the things that was frustrating, because I kind of went into it wanting to really like him. Mm-hmm. And there were things that I liked. Like, I guess now would be a good time to talk about Mormon doctrine as kind of a case study of this.
That's definitely probably the case study of his.
So there's a couple controversies that he handled. One was Von Brody's book, although that wasn't during his presidency, I don't think.
No, that was just prior to his presidency. But I mean, she was his
niece. She was his niece?
I believe so. Something like that.
Yeah. So he dealt with her book. He dealt with the evolution debate within church leaders, and then Mormon doctrine. And also, well, I guess part of the evolution debate was the publication of Man, His Origin, and His Destiny.
Right.
And all of these have a similar feel. And so I'll do a block quote thing just like the author, right? On page 50, Mormon doctrine was published without anyone knowing about it. There wasn't discussion ahead of time. It just kind of came out of nowhere. So McConkie had pushed for publishing this book without letting anyone know. I believe even his father-in-law, Joseph Fielding Smith, was surprised by it. And so McKay had, he got a copy of the book, And his secretary noted that he went through the whole thing. He had paper clips on all the pages where he had a question, and there were hundreds of them there. And then he summoned two senior apostles, Mark E. Peterson and Marion G. Romney. I asked them if they would go over Elder Bruce R. McConkie's book, Mormon Doctrine, and make a list of corrections. Peterson and Romney took 10 months to critique the book and make their report. Romney submitted a lengthy letter on January 7th in 1960 detailing what he felt were the most egregious errors in the book and noting its nature and scope and the authoritative tone of the style in which it is written pose the question as to the propriety of the authors attempting such a project without assignment and supervision from him whose right and responsibility it is to speak for the church on Mormon doctrine. On the same day, Peterson gave McKay an oral report in which he recommended 1,067 corrections that affected most of the 776 pages of the book. And so then later it says, it was agreed that the necessary corrections are so numerous that to republish a corrected edition of the book would be such an extensive repudiation of the original as to destroy the credit of the author. The republication of the book should be forbidden, and that the book should be repudiated in such a way as to save the career of the author as one of the general authorities of the church. And so it's just kind of quietly, we're not going to publish it anymore, but we're not going to come out and say that there were things wrong with it, at least not in a very clear way. And then
a decade later, or however long later, there's a tepid approval for him to go ahead with a second edition.
Yeah, and the quote was, so McConkie met with him, and he said, should the book be republished at this time, McConkie would be responsible for it, and that it will not be a church publication. 3 days after meeting with McKay, McConkie wrote in a memo to Claire Middlemiss, McKay's secretary, saying, President McKay indicated that the book should be republished at this time. And then Prince goes on to comment that McConkie, who practiced law prior to becoming a general authority, was well versed in the legal meaning of words. And so one is hard pressed to conclude that he misunderstood McKay's cautionary statement, should the book be republished, as a mandate to republish.
Right.
And so that kind of shows the desire McKay had for unanimity and agreement within the general authorities, protecting the character and the reputation of the general authorities over public doctrinal correction.
Right.
And it also gives you an idea of what Bruce R. McConkie was like, which many people right. already know, that he was very authoritative, forthright, and very confident in his opinion.
Right.
And also, it gives you an idea later in McKay's life, he did have that wishy-washy feel because he was mostly out of it, and people took advantage of that.
Now, another key theme of the book that I want to make sure we cover before we close this episode is the what I think is the gem of the book is one on the priesthood restriction, or the racial restriction, more appropriately called. Because what's fascinating in there is that Prince makes McKay seem like the transition president for eventually doing away with the racial restriction. And if McKay doesn't do it himself, he at least moves them far along the path, and he is the one that makes Mormon Church destined to eventually give up the policy. And most importantly, that he's the first one that ends up calling it a policy instead of a doctrine. Now, one can quibble with that and say, well, he calls it a doctrine in other places, but that's outside the scope of what we're discussing here.
Yeah, this is the famous or infamous church essay on race and the priesthood. There's either a footnote or a sentence in there that says McKay at one point prayed to seek revelation to lift the ban or know whether he should lift the racial restriction.
Uh-huh.
And he came away with an answer that he couldn't do it at this time. And if I don't have that marked right now, but it was like he was very frustrated with the whole thing. He was very confident that he was going to continue with the status quo but it seemed like he was either really tired that day or was just frustrated with the situation in general.
I would say that, you know, you get the answer to the prayer that you often seek, and he's someone who's all about unanimity. And if the answer is going to be something that was going to bring a lot of chaos within the 12, he's not going to get an answer to change it then.
Yeah. And as far as his political leanings, and what I mean is like social views,
right?
He's sometimes in some discussions and circles, he's kind of described as a progressive.
Right.
And, you know, if we reference Brigham Young again, he probably is quite progressive compared to Brigham Young. But there's other figures that show that he's more in the middle ground in the Mormon hierarchy.
Right.
But definitely he's conservative. He's not,
right.
He's yeah. not, he would never be considered a liberal in the broader American political arena.
Right. I think, and to be honest, I wish that would have been more of the theme of how he represents how the moderates are transitioning a bit rather than a liberal who's trying to push the transition.
Yeah.
You see like that difference? And what I think is the most poignant moment in the entire chapter is when the young David O. McKay goes on a world mission and goes to, I think it's Tahiti.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he ends up writing back about meeting, there's a woman who's a member of the church. She's married to a Tahitian who is determined to be black and therefore can't hold the priesthood. And he writes back this letter basically saying to Heber J. Grant, who's then the president, have you met these people? They're just like us. Are we sure we can't give them the priesthood?
Yeah.
and you can just see, I mean, and reading that really hit me for more than before, that these were people that really had very little experience with those of African descent. And that this would have been a big eye-opening experience for him that really shaped how he approached the issue in the future.
Yeah, it goes to show how crucial exposure is in forming informed opinions.
Right. So then McKay goes on to do a series of really important things, like he lessens the circle of who is affected by the racial restriction. He declares Polynesians are fine. He declares other people are fine, and he really narrows it down to who can be restricted, which in some ways is going to end up weakening the policy itself, which then sets the stage for, you know, the next decade.
Yeah. Yep. And it shows how a church of that size and of that conservative nature, the rate of change is not fast.
Right.
So right. It's incremental.
That's right.
If it's going to change at all. So the other interesting bit that I alluded to with Ezra Taft Benson was the chapter on communism.
Right.
And that was the one that by the end of that chapter, I just wanted to fall asleep. I just felt so tired. Not because the chapter was tedious, but, you know, putting myself in this aging president's shoes. And communism came after you learn about black civil rights and the priesthood, all the different growth initiatives and programs of the church with the education, the building program, the missionary program, the temple program. Then you get to communism. So you already have an idea of the many topics that the president of the church has to preside over, if you will.
Uh-huh.
And then you go into this communism chapter. The conflict is motivated by the state of the United States or the world at the time, and it's inflamed by Ezra Taft Benson having a prominent position.
Right. And I think reading the chapter can be quite shocking to modern readers because we're just not used to seeing an apostle be this political. I mean, Ezra Taft Benson was out there. He was bold spoken. He was upfront with his policies and politics. And I mean, this caused a lot of controversy. I can't imagine something like that happening in the modern church today with today's digital age. I mean, it would be quite different than what we know, which is, I mean, it puts McKay in a very tough situation because he doesn't want to publicly censure, but he does feel uncomfortable with what's going on. But it really is a crucial moment to show that this is the end of the political apostles, that Ezra Taft Benson ends up being the last apostle to be very overtly partisan in his discourse and rhetoric.
Yeah, and one example, like, people will be thinking of Elder Oak's memo from 1984 about a future plan of how the church should respond to homosexuality in the public sphere. And Elder Ballard speaking at the World Congress of Families, whatever that group was. At the time, Elder Benson's son was a member of the John Birch Society. And Elder Benson would often speak at these meetings and promote them. And his speeches in general conference were decidedly political. They were not centered on gospel topics. They were talking about communism being of Satan and things like that. And so it wasn't like today where you have overtures towards a social movement or a political idea. It was very clear and politically thesis-driven, his talks in general conference and his public activity.
Right, and it actually is important because it marks a shift to what we'll discuss in the next podcast about how the church, when they're addressing what would be typically seen as political issues, they have to frame it as moral issues.
Yes.
And that's based on a lot of the lessons that they learned from the period we're discussing with the Prince book.
So that's kind of a 10,000-foot view of all the details and the stories and the facts that you'll get in this book. Like, I gave it 5 stars on Goodreads. I found it to be really interesting. An insider's insider view, I guess, of the church is one way to look at it. So thanks again, Ben, for coming on and giving us a view of how this book fits into the broader New Mormon History, Mormon Studies framework.
Absolutely my pleasure, Brian. I look forward to next time.
Well, there you are. One more book to put on your shelf if you haven't read that one already. As for next week, we'll either wrap up this series with Ben, if I'm able to schedule and connect with him, or we'll present an interview with Mehdi Harrison, who is the author of The Bishop's Wife. Either way, you, as the listener, win. I'm going to throw one last reminder out there to go and check out the Indiegogo page for the Liahona Children's Foundation fundraiser. If it isn't over $10,000, do something to tip the scales, please. Thank you all for listening and hanging out with us. We try to make it fun every week, and I know I enjoy it. And until next time, keep keeping it weird.